Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, Armie Hammer on his critically acclaimed new film, Call Me By Your Name, that time he almost played Batman, and why he's not looking to play a superhero anymore. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. I'm Josh. This is Sammy.
I'm Armie.
No, you're not. You're not 9 feet tall and a Ken doll.
Yeah. Not yet.
A girl can dream.
Yeah.
Yes, the guest this week is the great Armie Hammer, having a real moment thanks to his fantastic performance in, as I said, it's a critically acclaimed film. It's called Call Me By Your Name. If you check out like the reviews on this one, you will find that virtually 100% of the folks that have seen it have fallen in love with it. And I totally agree. I've seen it twice. It's a beautiful piece of work. It's directed by this Italian filmmaker by the name of Luca Guadagnino, who did I Am Love and A Bigger Splash. And this one, I believe it's based on a novel. Mm-hmm. It stars Armie and a young actor by the name of Timothée Chalamet. Well, you were around when we chatted with both of them in Toronto.
In Toronto.
Right? They were great together.
They were so wonderful.
So this is like, it's a very like well-done, delicate kind of coming-of-age love story. It's a summer in Italy. It has its own kind of very like specific pace and tone. And it's just a lush, beautiful film that like makes you, you know, it transports you to another time and place. It takes place in the 80s, and both Timothy and Armie are fantastic in it, as is, by the way, Michael Stuhlbarg, who plays Timothy's father in the film. This is going to be another major awards player, perhaps for Armie, perhaps for Timothy, perhaps for Michael. It's an embarrassment of riches. So very excited to talk to Armie about this very, very special film. And we're all Armie Hammer fans.
Yeah, right? I was going to say, how were things with Armie?
So here's the thing. I had said to Sammy, maybe going into Toronto or coming out of Toronto, like for whatever, I've talked to Armie a bunch over the years, like, you know, for Social Network, I was on the set with him for Mirror, Mirror, and like random things. I just feel like we never vibed. I feel like he didn't like me.
You felt like you were giving and he was taking.
I just felt like he just didn't appreciate the Horowitz wit.
That every time you talk to him, you show him fan art of him dressed as superheroes that he doesn't want to play.
I did do that in Toronto, and he probably didn't. He was perfectly nice about it, but I clearly didn't love that.
For the record, I disagreed. I thought you guys had great chemistry. He was happy to see you.
Okay.
But you were really insecure about it.
I was insecure, and I will say, he was fantastic. Maybe he was, maybe this was all in my head or what, but we had a fantastic conversation. He's a great interview and very honest and open about his career and, you know, his background. It's kind of a fascinating story.
Does he know that he's gorgeous?
he's very aware.
Like, do you think he knows?
Yes, I think he's aware of his physical attributes, his God-given
gifts.
It's
bizarre.
Yes, he's tall.
See him in real life, it's like, is that art?
It's kind of crazy. And he's very open. He was born into privilege. How many people like came of age in the Cayman Islands? That's literally like where he spent like his teen years. So he owns that, though. He talks about it and he gets it.
Which even makes him cooler.
Yeah, and I have to say, I'm a fan of his. And I'm happy that we had this kind of conversation. Maybe it was just the length of the conversation that let me kind of like see different sides of him. And he's a great storyteller too, by the way. He's just like,
he's perfect.
There's some gems in this about his wedding and about his dancing skills. His dancing skills are very evident in the new film, Call Me By Your Name. And yes, we geek out yet again. I did this with Jay Baruchel recently, and I sometimes feel guilty about bringing up this project, but I'm still so fascinated by it. You know, as film geeks know, Armie was cast as Batman in the Justice League movie, not the one that just came out, but the one that was going to happen like 10 years ago, directed by George Miller. And Jay Baruchel had some amazing stories when he was on the podcast a couple months ago. Go back and check that out if you want. And Army was just as open and had some fantastic, fantastically interesting things to say about specific scenes from that film that we'll never see. But I think I and any like superhero and film fan is still fascinated by. So and he's also very honest about kind of the superhero thing, about like where he stands with it, because, you know, as we said, he doesn't want to do it. Well, he's often in the mix for these things. I think like with the right opportunity he would do it, but you know, I'll let him speak for himself about why he has more than mixed feelings about putting on tights and a cape.
I feel all right about it, I'll tell you that.
Sure you do. You gross.
I'm fine lady. With it, hey.
So anyway, that's the conversation coming up with Armie Hammer. Go check out Call Me By Your Name. It's a special little film, and it's going to be around for a bit, I think, through the award season, but go seek it out. And in the meanwhile, remember to review, rate, and subscribe.
Review, rate, and subscribe.
It's a trifecta. Or you can do one of the three. You don't have to do all three.
Yeah, but if you're there, you might as well do all three.
If you're on iTunes, guys,
you're not going to go and just do one.
Yeah, you can just like hit the 5-star. Not to plant that in your head, but I mean, what else are you
going to
do?
But also, right, you're not going on to... Well, I won't give anyone ideas.
Don't give my ideas.
Yeah.
But while you're there, write a couple nice words about Sammy and me,
yes,
and me
it
too.
It means a lot.
It honestly, it does mean a lot to her.
It's my fuel.
She needs this, guys.
I need this.
I'm saying this not for
I'm
the podcast.
30 now.
I'm saying this for my own well-being. We need to keep her going. We need to keep her alive.
Please.
That's all she has are iTunes reviews.
Value me.
Oh, no. Anyway. Please do that and enjoy this conversation with Armie Hammer. It's good to see you as always, man. Congratulations again on this one.
Thanks, Josh. Appreciate it. Good to see you too.
I saw it again last night.
Does that bother you, the hissing sound coming
out? You know
what?
It's just going to be one of those things we're going to deal with, I think.
Fair enough.
Right?
Fair enough.
For those that can hear the hissing in the background, we are slowly being gassed to death.
For those who can hear the hissing noise in the background, turn it down. You're listening too loud.
Exactly. So, yeah, we've
I guess you're listening too loudly.
Loudly,
you
got to
conjugate your adverbs.
You're so good. You're so smart. We've come a long way since the set of Mirror, Mirror.
Good God. Yes.
Happier times. I mean, that was a happy experience, hopefully. Was it?
Yeah, it was great to go to Montreal. Great to work with Tarsa. Yeah, it was great.
Those sets were cool. There was a lot to it. We'll circle around. This film is obviously a special one. I saw it for the second time last night, and it's... I don't think I've met somebody that it hasn't worked with. Not to like jinx you or this through this fun ride, but like it's just for whatever reason, it really just resonates.
Great. Now you've just challenged one person to be like, yeah, I didn't like it.
I want to meet that person. Actually, I don't want to meet that person.
Me neither.
That guy sounds like an asshole.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. How do you hate love? Come on, man.
What do you think that you could have done this one like 5 years ago? Is this something that like is
no? You know, that's a great question. I think that this movie took every single bit of cumulative knowledge that I had, because I've said it before that there's no distractions in this movie. There's no green screen. There's no special effects. There's no monsters. There's no big set pieces. There's nothing to distract you from the fact that the only thing that propels this movie from scene to scene is the emotional life of these two people and how they connect and how that drives the story. And if at any point that didn't work or it fell flat, the movie wouldn't work. And that's a huge, daunting challenge and responsibility for an actor, you know, to think that if I have a moment of dishonesty on film, people will pick it up and realize it, because the whole point of this is watching these two people progressively fall in love with each other.
And I know one of the words that keeps coming up in the talking about the film, and you've probably used it yourself, is intimacy. It feels like such an intimate film. That's one of those intangible things, though. That's the tough thing about a movie like this. It's like, if you're doing a comedy, you kind of get a sense, like, okay, that's a funny line. That at least makes me laugh.
And you also know in a comedy, if you say it, it's either funny or it's not.
Right.
You know, like
with
something like this, because you're playing this sort of like unknown territory, and you're playing with just human emotion. It's all kind of all over the place. But fortunately, we had someone like Luca helming the ship.
Yeah. What's on set, is there a particular piece of wisdom or advice or whatever that Luca gave you that kind of helped you steer in the right direction?
Oh, dude. I mean, there wasn't There wasn't a single moment on set that didn't feel like Luca was in complete control and that he knew exactly what he was going for and knew exactly what he needed. But then there also was this amazing sense of freedom where he was just letting it live.
Yeah.
And you can feel that in the movie, that he just lets moments live and he gives them their time to live in space. You know, like the best example of that is there's one scene where Oliver and Elio ride bikes past the camera and they continue to ride. And
right.
They continue to ride and continue
it
to ride.
It holds for a bit. Yeah.
If it was an American film, they would have been like, oh, well,
get out of there.
We need 2 minutes somewhere else, so let's cut that, blah, blah, blah. But he's like, no, I want to give the audience time to realize that these two people are just in their own world
yeah.
and riding off together. And it's like, it's such a simple but beautiful moment. And that's kind of part and parcel and a perfect example of how Luca directed the whole thing.
Is this a film that's like replete with moments where you feel like you're out on a limb, like you're kind of like, you're pushing yourself and you feel scared as an actor? Or do you feel once you're in it, and that the first couple of days go by, you're like, okay, this feels right, and I'm acting in the right key for him, and this, me and Timothy have a thing or whatever.
Yeah, both really. This movie was definitely something that challenged and pushed me as, you know, a creative individual, and sort of Luca pushed me and challenged me and unrelentingly sort of made it about this honesty and this whole thing. And so we did have to do things that, you know, I'd never done on film before, or, you know, or that I was uncomfortable with, but it also simultaneously felt so safe
yeah.
because it was just like, it was such an atmosphere of love and understanding and openness and acceptance that anything that happened was okay.
Right.
And that's beautiful, you know?
And to be clear, Army's talking about dancing, not any
yeah,
of the
yeah,
sex
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Just the dancing scene. I hated that scene so much.
So have you accepted your newfound fame as a meme? This is a big moment for you, man. Congrats.
I'm after this movie, I'm quitting, and I'm just going right to Dancing with the Stars. That's it for me. Yep. I've found my calling, and I just want to dance, Josh. That's it.
There's a lot of you on the dance floor.
Too much. Like, it's... Unless you are a professionally trained dancer, you really have no business being on a dance floor if you're 6'5 and over, because you're going to bump into somebody, you're going to throw a gangly arm over here and catch somebody in the back of the head or something.
So did you need like a little liquid courage that day, or what helps you through something
you know,
like that?
That probably would have helped. Yeah, I mean, I don't know any time when alcohol doesn't help dancing. In fact, I can emphatically say that that is the only time in my life I have ever danced stone sober. Because I've never in any other time in my life been like, you know, I'm just sober, I'm feeling good,
yeah.
Let's just go dance, guys.
Did you dance at your own wedding?
I did, oh yeah, but yeah. I was also not sober. I was very not sober.
Yeah,
we danced until like 8 in the morning at the wedding. Yeah,
I did only one dance at my wedding. I can't
really?
Do it. I just can't do it.
You did the dance.
I did the
and
dance.
Then no
that
more.
Was it. Yeah.
Oh man. Oh. Well, by the time the dance,
there's not
was
enough
over,
alcohol in the world for me, Army, that can make me do that.
Well, I can tell you this: my father-in-law is in the wine and spirit distribution business. So one of the wedding gifts that he gave us was a truckload, and I'm talking like, you know, those massive U-Hauls, like the really big ones.
Sure.
They loaded it so full of alcohol for our wedding that my two brothers-in-law, John and Joseph, who had to drive it out to California from Colorado, had to drive around the state of Utah because it was too much alcohol to bring into the state of Utah. That's how much alcohol we had at our wedding. So I guarantee you there was enough there.
Yeah. Yeah. What about the karaoke? Does it take much to get you in a karaoke bar?
Short of a nuclear blast, there's not much that would get me to a karaoke bar. I think the last time I went to a karaoke bar was actually in Japan.
Well, yeah.
And I was like, this still isn't any better.
This doesn't
I still
feel right.
Hate
this doesn't feel right.
Because the thing about karaoke for me is like, you've always got that one friend or one person who's
yeah,
like,
who's a
let's
ringer.
Go to karaoke.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you go and you're like, of course you wanted to come. You're fucking good.
You're
like, look
off.
At you. Like, yeah, we get it. You can sing. Okay, sit down and shut up. Now you're just making us all feel bad.
Yeah. It's like playing like a shirts and skins game with you. Like, I don't want to play with you. I get it. You have a good body, Army. Congrats.
You don't know what's under here. It's ugly. It's
no,
ugly.
I saw the movie. Yeah. I can see it. Yeah, I feel like half the movie you guys are just like shirtless.
Yep.
Not much spent on wardrobe.
No, not much spent on wardrobe. And I don't think I've ever seen shorter shorts in my entire life.
But there is, I mean, in relative seriousness, I mean, you have to like feel super comfortable with, you know, the more kind of, again, to use the word, intimate moments. Like, I mean, Timothy's like grabbing your crotch. Like, that's not day one of a shoot normally.
Right. Yeah.
And that, and you have to like get to that point where you feel like. Yeah.
I mean, I grab my crotch pretty much all the time. Yeah, so my crotch is pretty much used to it.
You're kind of the Michael Jackson
totally.
Of 2017.
Totally. Yeah.
I don't know where to go from there. Okay, let's circle back around. Okay, yeah. So because obviously
back to my crotch, or
yeah, back to your crotch. Okay. Tell me about your crotch. No, about career-wise. So like when we started talking, like you started talking to most people in my biz was around obviously Social Network. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like, I mean, you have two kids now. You got married around the time of Social Network.
Yeah.
So like, do you feel like that guy is a totally alien creature to the army that's sitting with me today, or?
You know, yes and no would be the easy answer for that. You know, because I think the whole, well, it's not necessarily that I think. I'm pretty sure that the whole point of life is, you know, your evolution as a person.
Yeah.
You know, no one stays the same at 23, 24 as they are when they're 53, 54. You know, you've lived and you've learned and you've grown, and hopefully anyway, you know, and especially as an actor, I get to work on all these different projects, and each one of them I get to focus on something new, something totally different.
Yeah.
And I get to challenge my perspective in a fun, interesting new way every time. So hopefully I'm a very different person than I was. And I mean, I'm still essentially the same person. I'm me.
Yeah.
And I'm happy with me, but I'm still always convinced that me has room to grow.
I don't have kids. Did having kids kind of automatically mature you a bit?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, it's... Beyond the fact that, you know, it definitely changes your sleep patterns and it changes like all those things, you now have like a life that you're responsible for.
Yeah.
A life that is completely dependent on you. And that's huge, you know? So.
Did you need some maturing? Did you feel like, were you kind of like, you seem like a relatively.
I still need maturing,
no.
Dude. For sure. Ask my wife. Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, but at the same time, like, I'm youthfully enthusiastic about life, and I think that's a good quality. But at the same time, you know, I think everybody can grow and mature in
sure.
some way.
Do you think that, you know, in the successes and failures that have come, you know, since Social Network, and you can, that there's a, you know, what constitutes a success, what constitutes a failure, that's a,
sure.
another conversation. But seeing the films that do or don't resonate with audiences, whether it's box office or commercially or in your own heart, whatever, does that make this process a little different in terms of like, I guess my question is, at what point do you trust your instincts that this movie worked? Like, are you like still waiting for like the actual public to take it in, and or are you kind of pessimistic or optimistic having gone through the process a bit now?
I would say I'm sort of like realistic about it,
right.
You know, because I've been in this situation before where people have gone, this is going to be huge.
Right.
Like, oh, this is going to be great, blah, 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 blah. And then it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Like, for me, as an actor and as a performer in a movie, my job is really done the last time the director says cut.
Right.
On the last day when he says cut, that's a wrap. I'm done. Like, my job is, so now he's going to go edit it. He's going to go do his whole thing. And then eventually they're going to call me again to do like a whole song and dance and
sure.
sort of get out there and be like, oh, everybody should go see this movie, blah, 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 blah. But I can't change anything that happened in the experience.
Right.
All of those experiences, especially the ones that had more expectations on them or
right.
more, you know, more pressure on them, those made this experience feel all the more valuable.
Yeah.
Because I did this because I believed in the story and I believed in the script and I wanted to work with Luca Guadagnino, and my experience was one of the most rewarding I've ever had while working on a film.
Yeah.
So
does this teach you to trust your gut all the more going forward, or what's the lesson learned of, like, career-wise, is there a lesson to be learned from something like this?
I think, yeah, but the thing for me is, like, I don't even really think about it in terms of, like, my career as sort of like a holistic whole.
Sure.
I think of it as, like, experience to experience.
Right.
So I trusted my gut on this one, and it paid off.
Yeah.
I've also trusted my gut on other ones where halfway through shooting, I just look at myself and I go, why the fuck are you here? This is terrible.
Right.
You are not enjoying this. You're not having fun. But this was one of those experiences. But it also was an experience that showed me that all of the conversations that I had as a young actor with, you know, acting teachers or other acting students in class and all that, of, you know, the times where they sit around and go, you know, you will do a movie that makes you grow as an artist and challenges your perspective and forces you to mature, like all that stuff.
It's not all bullshit. It actually
it's not all bullshit. You can do that. And I did it. And now I'm like, I want to do that more. You
yeah.
know?
When have you been most shocked by like how a film turned out? And you can take that any way you want in terms of like the actual product or how it was received or what. Is there one that stands out to you that sort of?
I'll keep it on the positive side for this one and just say that this one. You know, I mean, I never even considered how this film would turn out the entire time we were shooting. I never thought about who's going to see it, who's going to be interested, how's it going to do, how's it going to perform, is it going to be a box office success?
Right.
None of those questions ever entered my mind. So now everything that's happening is sort of just like, whoa. It's kind of the fact that it's resonating with people so much validates how much it resonated with me in the process of making it.
Totally.
Yeah.
So since we have some time, let's go back to a little bit, even further back.
Sure.
I think you're the first guest on the podcast that came of age at the Cayman Islands. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah.
All I know of that environment is, you know, references in The Firm.
Sure.
So what is that a fun place to kind of like come of age? And like, what you consider like the most important years of your life were spent, at least formatively?
Yeah, man. I mean, definitely like my formative young years that I remember. You know, I lived in Dallas before that and I lived in L.A. before that. But I don't really remember L.A. and I remember Dallas, but like, all, like, if someone says, you know, your childhood, my mind immediately goes back to palm trees and tropical paradise. You know, I had a machete that I sharpened all the time. I mean, you could cut paper with it.
Right.
And I would come home from school, throw down my backpack, grab my machete, jump on my dirt bike, and just ride around and go see friends, go do whatever. If I got hungry, I'd cut down a papaya or climb a coconut tree, get a coconut down, and then just, like, go fishing, go swimming. In the morning before school, I'd swim with sea turtles and feed them by hand. It was just like... is bizarre. It's just a bizarre way to grow up.
And for people that can't see Army here, which is only just me, he's in a loincloth right now with a machete, which is
true.
Like, so old this, habits die hard.
Yeah. They said I was going to the jungle. I didn't realize it was the concrete jungle. I feel like I got sold a false bill of goods.
So how do you announce you're going to be an actor? Like, what's the big conversation in the Hammer household? Because I know it didn't go down so well.
Well, I just basically said I want to be an actor, and they just started laughing at me. And I was like, no, really? And I was living in the Caymans at the time, and they were like, what do you mean? You want to do, like, island theater? Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, what's the theatrical scene in the Cayman Islands?
There, I don't know what it is now because I haven't been in several years, but there was one movie theater that had two screens, and that was it.
It's a multiplex. That constitutes a multiplex.
It is a multiplex. Yeah. Funny story, when Titanic came out while I was living down in the Caymans, and it was such a huge, like, smash success. I mean, I think it was, like, one of the first movies to make $1 billion or something
like
that.
Totally.
But they were making so much money off of it that the people who owned the theater were like, well, shit, let's just put it on both screens. So for months, Titanic was the only movie playing in the Cayman Islands. But I also loved going to the movies so much that I wasn't going to stop going to the movies.
Sure.
I probably watched Titanic in theaters 5 or 6 times because it was the only thing.
So how much tension was there in the household, like, around the time where, like, you were starting to commit yourself or wanted to commit yourself, and they obviously, it wasn't necessarily what a lot of parents don't necessarily want their kids to go and do something that's so dicey a profession, you know?
Sure. It's a crazy idea, but it's like that that great expression of, you know, you don't find reasonable men at the tops of tall mountains. Like, you don't find reasonable people who go, no, I want no job security and I don't want health benefits and I want, you know, I want rejection and I want to be judged and, you know, the whole thing.
Totally.
It's tough. And, you know, if my kids came to me and said they wanted to do it, I would try to be as supportive of what they wanted, but, like, my heart would break for them a little bit, knowing what they have to go through in this business. It's not an easy thing to get into, and that's almost a good thing because it weeds out the people who truly aren't passionate about it. Like, anyone who wants to go into it just because they want to be famous or just because they want to blah, 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 or they want the attention or they want the lifestyle that they think it brings, which it really doesn't, but, like, they want that lifestyle.
Sure.
You know they're going to burn out. They're not going to be able to take it because it's fucking rough, you know?
So was it your form of rebellion? Because, you know, from the outside looking in, like, you know, and you've been very open, obviously. You led a life of privilege. You know, you came from wealth. And, you know, you obviously have been gifted with some great assets. But, like, is that a way to kind of, like, you know, counter the system or break through in some way?
Yeah, maybe. I haven't really kind of thought about it in that sense, but I'm sure that's part of it, you know, because part of me doing it involved dropping out of high school and telling everyone that I'm going to go take control of my own life and do what I want to do, you know. I think for someone who grew up in my situation, there's a lot of expectation and a lot of pressure, and you know, I mean, now looking back, it just sounds so ridiculous to think about. But, like, I remember being told every day, like, when you go outside, you represent the family. You are a Hammer. And you are going to go to college, and then you're going to go get your MBA at Columbia because there's an Arm & Hammer building there and blah, 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 blah. So it's like, if you let it, all of those things can dictate what you're going to do for the rest of your life. And it's truly a powerless proposition where you're just like, I have no control. I just have to do this thing because everyone else in my family has done this thing. And it sounds like it'll make me miserable. So are they miserable also? Like, I don't get it. Like, why would you do that? So, yeah, I'm sure it was like a big form of rebellion of me being like, I don't want to be told what to do. Like, I want to make my own decisions. I want to be my own man. And that's kind of tough because it probably would have been a lot easier to just go with the system. Sure. Like, now, speaking of job security, now I got it. I know what I'm going to do. Like, this is great. I don't have to worry about cash ever again. Like, as opposed to being an actor where you're like, oh boy, now, oh man, oh gee, you know, the whole thing.
So, and in those first years before we all got to know you on the social network, were you making a living? Like, at what point was, like, were you consistently working?
I was doing like TV jobs here and there, not enough to like really make a living.
Yeah.
And, you know, to my parents' credit, even though they weren't happy with what I was doing, they weren't going to let me starve to death.
Right.
You know, so
they helped you through a little bit at least.
Yeah, they definitely helped me through. And I feel really fortunate to have had that, you know. I mean, it was like a wonderful opportunity for me to really pursue something. And I know that not everybody gets that. And I know that like financial reasons can be a huge reason why some people don't follow their dreams, you know. And I was allowed to follow my dreams, you know. I mean, it wasn't easy, and it definitely wasn't something where, you know, I was like, I don't have to worry about this. Like, it was always something that I was aware of. And I also, it embarrassed the fuck out of me every time I had to go to them and be like, I need help. And I'm going to pay you back. Like, you know, this whole, because I didn't want to have to do that. I wanted to be my own man.
Of course.
You know, and I, it's always tough when you have to go to somebody, especially your parents who told you that this isn't the right thing to do. And then you have to go back and ask them for help. It's a big slice of humble pie to have to eat, you know?
Were there, I mean, ironically, your big break, for those that do or don't know, was a film that we never saw. It was essentially was the Justice League film.
Yeah.
Getting that, I know, helped get you other jobs.
For sure, for sure.
Well, even before that, I want to come to that in a second, but even before that, were there close calls and other gigs that you thought were going to change your life that just didn't come to fruition? Because it's such a giant leap to go from virtually nowhere to being Batman in a George Miller film.
Yeah. That was like when I was 19, so I'd really only been doing it aggressively for like a year something like that. So there was like tiny roles in little independent films that nobody would ever see again,
right?
And maybe nobody ever saw in the first place. So there was enough to keep me hooked.
Got it.
But there was not enough to
actually make it
survive on, like, not at all. And then Justice League happened.
So what's the moment getting that part?
That was crazy.
I can only imagine, for Ben Affleck getting it, it's a huge part, and he's won Oscars.
And he's Ben Affleck. Yeah, exactly.
And you were, frankly, a nobody at the time.
100%, 100%. I was just a kid with a goofy name. I can specifically remember getting the phone call and then being like, you got the part in the movie. And because we didn't know what part we were going in for. Like,
oh, really?
They didn't say you're going in for a Batman. You're blah, 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 blah. It was nothing. Like, literally nothing like
that.
They didn't even give us scenes from the movie. I had to do my audition scene was that Ned Beatty monologue from Network, where he's like, you have meddled with the primal forces of nature, Mr. Beale. Like, that, I had to give that monologue, which is an Academy Award-winning monologue.
Right.
So I remember working my ass off on that and going in, doing it, and then getting the call, and then being like, you're going to play Batman in this movie. I was just like, what the fuck are you talking about? And it was just the craziest thing.
Were you going to do the Batman growl? Were you going to do the...
No. It was a totally different... It was darker, and it was... You know, it's funny. It was pre-Christian Bale, But the Christian Bale Batman had a lot more in common with it than any of the previous ones.
Oh, really?
Like, whether it be the George Clooney, the Michael Keaton, you know, the, all those, which were almost campy.
Right.
This one was about a guy who is severely psychologically almost deranged.
Right.
You know, I mean, it was dark, and it was really intense, and this guy had major trust issue, you know, the whole thing, and it was a great concept, and it was a really cool idea.
I know it must feel weird to keep talking about something like this that never came to fruition, but it's one of those projects, and it's like, I think I told you recently, I got a chance to catch up with Jay Baruchel.
He told me some
amazing stories on and off the set that you guys clearly had a good time in Australia.
We had the best time, love that guy.
Yeah, he's a character in itself. Here's my one last question. I don't know if something will come to mind. He gave me a couple scenes that jumped out at him that were like, he told me like the introduction of Wonder Woman where she like beheads like a Minotaur.
Was there
like a scene that you, to your dying day, will wish that you had seen realized on the big screen that still jumps out at you from that script?
Superman and Wonder Woman have, or had, the most brutal fight with each other that you've ever seen. And I mean, it would be like when two superheroes actually fight, like they destroy multiple cities like by accident because they're just like they don't even see anything else other than like trying to destroy the person in front of them. And it was incredible. I mean, at one point they destroy an aircraft carrier by accident. Like, it was and then also the death count was going to be extremely high because Jay Baruchel, did he tell you about his character?
Yeah.
Okay, so he plays this guy, Maxwell Lord. Who had, like, one of the things that he has is like a fast food chain, and he, which is everywhere. Like, imagine if it would be like McDonald's or something. But inside of all the food that he's been preparing for people, he's putting like nanobots. And this is back when no one knew about nanobots.
Right.
Like, this wasn't anything that we talked about.
Sure.
And so everyone's consuming this food like an addiction because he's putting like shit in it to make people addicted to it too. And then they're consuming these nanobots. And then at one point, like, he pushes a button that's like activate. And these nanobots literally, like, kill almost every person that has eaten his food and turn them into these, like...
There's a commentary there for the, like, the masses that are eating shitty fast food.
By the way, I don't doubt that that was an intentional commentary about it. But, and then all of a sudden you have to fight these, like, nanobot humans that are, like, now programmed to be, like, kill all these guys. Like, and it was just, it was amazing. Yeah, let's see. What else stands out? Oh, they also had Martian Manhunter in it, who's played by Hugh Keyes Byrne, who was the toe cutter in the first one, who then played Immortal Joe.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Amazing. And he was amazing, and a little bit like a Martian himself in all the best ways. Like, I love that guy. He's incredible. But
so where are you at right now with the whole superhero thing, which always will come up and always has come up? And I know, like, you know, early on, you seemed open to it post, like, Social Network. And, like, it, you know, it's an honor to be in those kind of conversations. Do you still feel that way, or do you feel like I'm good? It's working without that whole thing, or what?
Yeah, man. It's just, I'm trying to answer in a way that's not going to get me in any trouble.
Wait, have you signed on to something you can't talk about? Is that what's happening?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
Because all right, fuck it. Let's might as well go for it. Are you shaking your head? I haven't seen a superhero movie in a long time where I thought, fuck, I wish I was in that.
Right.
You know? So for me, there's not like a huge rush.
You don't feel you're missing out if you're seeing.
I really don't. I mean, would I love to own a huge house? Yes, for sure. But at the end of the day, like, I'm more interested now in my artistic credibility and doing the projects that satiate me as an artist and make me feel like I'm doing what I love. Because I tried doing the big movies. Right. You know, I tried doing that. And there was like almost like an effort to get me to do these things, and it just didn't work.
Yeah.
And at the end of the movie, I didn't feel like I was any better for it than when I started. Whereas, you know, these passion projects that you do, you sign on because you truly believe in it, and then you devote every single thing to it, and you're out there, and you're like in the trenches. This movie we shot for nothing. Like, it literally at almost every turn.
You're not sitting in your trailer for half the time.
Dude,
you're working. You're...
Everyone has to carry gear on these movies.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that feels like it's like soul-quenching in a way that being a tiny cog in a massive machine wouldn't be.
Right. Well, as someone that just came, I'll say it because you can't. I just came literally for this morning. I want to catch up on Justice League just to see it. I don't think you're missing out, Army. You're doing good.
I'm telling you, dude. I'm telling you. Yeah. I think. I mean, look, if a great director came around and was like, look, I have this idea.
If George Miller wants to do a superhero movie,
if George Miller wants to do anything, I would do it for sure. But at the end of the day, like, no one's asked, and I'm not going out of my way to do it.
Yeah. So Social Network, which obviously made your career in a tangible sense after the would-be Justice League movie.
Right.
I mean, is the learning curve on that, like, huge, though? Because it's not only, like, a high-profile movie. It's Sorkin dialogue. It's Fincher, who's just obviously the most notorious of idiosyncratic in a very interesting way, filmmakers.
To put it nicely.
What did you feel like out of your element, or did you feel like you were ready for that? I mean, you obviously, the proof is in the pudding. You delivered. But, like, was there a bit of a learning curve of the first days in that one?
Yeah, I mean, it was intense. It was intense. But it would be like, I always say, like, Social Network was like running a marathon, and it feels like almost every movie since then has been like a 10K. So after you run a marathon, a 10K doesn't seem like it's that hard,
right?
And also, to be honest, I had two amazing crutches in that movie. I had David Fincher directing and Aaron Sorkin dialogue. So that it's almost hard to deliver Aaron Sorkin dialogue poorly.
Right.
Like, you really have to try to fuck it up.
I've never been on his set. I've talked to him. I know what he's like. I've heard a thousand stories, and I respect the hell out of him. He's a genius. Is he a nurturing filmmaker, though? He seems to be the kind of guy that's like, you either deliver or not.
Oh, not on set. Not, yeah, oh, absolutely like, not. No. And he doesn't want to sit around and talk about your character. Right. He doesn't want
to
sit around.
He hired
and, like,
you to do a job to do it.
And he'll tell you that to your face. He'll go, I don't want to talk to you about this. I have hired you because I think you're the best person to do this job.
Right.
So don't prove me wrong and do your job. You go, okay.
Hey, it's a vote of confidence, and then when you're on set
and you're doing, you know, 60, 70 takes of one camera setup, he'll just go, cut, do it again. Cut, do it again.
Right.
Cut, do it again. Cut, do it again. You go, do you want anything different? He'll go, do it again. Go, well, do you want me to do it again? Oh, okay.
It's fascinating. Yeah. It's amazing. Did you spend much time with, not to like go towards a lightning rod, but did Kevin Spacey, was he involved much in that production?
I'll be perfectly honest. I didn't even know he was a producer on the film until the rat party. And I was like, what's Kevin Spacey doing here? And they're like, oh, he's the producer of the movie. He's one of the producers. And I was like, really? Oh, okay. Yeah.
So coming out of that, did you feel emboldened or paralyzed by the kind of like expectation and success of that one? Did you feel like this is the beginning of the rest of my life and here come opportunities, or shit, like I now need to like follow up a David Fincher?
Neither. I think I was young and dumb and I just had no idea.
That
and I was like,
oh,
well.
That worked well.
I think I went through the Social Network press tour like a golden retriever puppy, where I was just like, where are we going now? Okay, cool. Oh, now we're going to get on a plane and fly somewhere? Cool. Like, a private plane? Whoa, even better, you know?
And was J. Edgar, like, one of the first things you did after?
Yeah, it was immediately after, yeah.
It's so funny to think, like, again, talking about Fincher's style, like, you can't go from a more different kind of a filmmaker, it would seem.
Dude.
Quint does one or two takes, max, right?
I've never experienced that kind of, you know, shock before, like, you know, coming from a David Fincher film where I know for a fact there are scenes that we did more than 100 takes of just one camera angle, and then they have to move the camera and then you start all over again. I could tell you for a fact, my first day on J. Edgar, I show up on set and they go, I still have not met Clint. So they go, okay, they're ready for you. And I was like, and they go, okay, go get hair and makeup, go do the whole thing, and go to your trailer, and we'll come get you when they're ready.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. So I go through the works, I go to my trailer, I'm there, I'm like, I'm psyching myself up, I'm going over my lines, I'm thinking about the scenes, you know, and I'm really kind of doing my actor thing. And then someone comes up and goes, knock, 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 and they go, they're ready for you. And I go, okay, great. So I go to set, and I walk into set, and we're shooting in a movie theater, and they walk me up, and it's Leo DiCaprio, Clint Eastwood, and Dame Judi Dench sitting in a movie theater, like in a row next to each other. And the guy goes, that's your seat. And he points to the seat that Clint's in. So I was like, okay.
Is someone else going to tell him to move?
Yeah, because it's not going to be me. I'll tell you that for a fact. So then I kind of just like stand there. And like they're having like a conversation. And then I like keep standing there. And then I keep standing there. And I keep standing there. And then finally Clint looks up and he goes, oh, you must be Army. All right, come on, let's do this. And so I get up, and I now sit in the seat that he was in. And we still, that's the most that we've spoken.
Right.
So I was like, oh, yeah, yes, yes, sir, sure. So I sit down on the thing, and then he sits like in a chair kind of a little bit removed from us while the camera's looking at us on the thing. And he goes, you know, so in this scene, you're watching the movie, and it's on the screen. It's a good movie. You like the movie. You're proud of it. Maybe you even look at each other and have a moment where, you know, you feel proud of the movie.
Right.
And so we're talking, and I go, do you mean something like this? And I look at Leo, and he looks at me, and he goes, yep, just like that. All right, moving on. And I go, wait, what? He goes, yep, we got it.
Wait,
and that was,
what?
Like, the camera was rolling. Like, that was our take. There was no rehearsal. That's there was no guy. That was it. And I literally just, like, sat in the chair, and, like, my palms started sweating. And I was like, what is going on around here? Because Social Network was really my only experience. Yeah, I mean, we did some stuff for Justice League and camera tests and all that, like, and some scenes we did. But, like, I don't know where those are. Someone's got to have those. But that was the first... that was the only other actual film I'd ever been in. So I had no frame of reference, and like that just continued through the rest of the time. Like, it was just that fast.
Is it valuable for you at this point now to, like, know how the director is going to shoot, whether it's that polarizing extreme of Fincher or Clint before
yes.
you step on set? Is
yes.
that something you make a point of knowing?
Sometimes you can't get that information beforehand because
right.
sometimes they don't know. Sometimes, you know, whatever.
But you can talk to people that have worked with them and
yeah,
you can
like, yeah,
snoop
sure.
around a little bit.
For sure. I mean, if I was diligent enough to do that, then I probably could. But also, that's a big part of what we do as actors is like I have my routine and I have what I know works for me and my process and what I need. Like, I know that I need to do a lot of research. I know that I need to have my lines so completely memorized that I don't think about them for a second, because if I spend a minute thinking about my lines in the scene, then I'm already sucked out of it.
Yeah.
So I know these things about my process. And that's like the challenge of an actor is figuring out how to make your process work with the director's process, because every director has a different process.
Right.
So you can't just come in and like force your way into like, well, no, I need this. You have to learn how to make your shit work with their shit.
Yeah. Are you the kind of like, is there a filmmaker you're curious about their process and sort of seeing like if I could work in that environment or how, as you said, your style would kind of mesh with theirs?
Yeah, you know, there are some directors that do everything extremely fast and loose and like all handheld camera,
yeah.
you know, like, so I, like Cronenberg shoots that way. I don't know. There's like, there are dudes where you're like, I don't know how that would work for me. And it seems like
kind of
a fun challenge. Yeah.
And what's like Wheatley like, for instance, Ben Wheatley? Is that
he's amazing, dude. He's fantastic. And his process exists entirely to service the edit. You know, he has a full edit bay built on set when he's shooting.
Because he wants to see it coming together as it goes.
Yeah, because this is like his background. He knows how to edit, and he's editing in real time. So
right.
there's a feed coming directly from the camera right to his edit station.
Huh.
And so as this footage is coming in, he's going... And it's like... He's not going, okay, let me cut this and paste this here. Nope, let me move that a few frames. He's literally not looking at the keyboard, which is not a normal keyboard. It's got like all these symbols on it. And he's just like, so by the end of the day, he's got everything from that day cut together. And on the end of the last day, he's got an assembly of the film. So he can watch it and go, I need one shot of someone's hand grabbing this gun because we didn't see that. And also I need this to establish the camera direction and I need this, blah, 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 blah. So it's really efficient filmmaking.
Do you feel at this point, I mean, I've talked to a lot of actors who like, I mean, and it can be an actor that's been working for 40 years that has a bunch of Oscars to their credit, and they still feel like they're at risk of being fired on every project. Are you that kind of an actor, or are you the kind of actor that like, you're secure, and I don't mean this is a negative thing, but you're secure enough where you are now that you deserve a place at the table, and you're going to...
No, I don't feel that I deserve a place at the table, but like... At the end of the day, you can't go in there worried about getting fired because
that's
at the end of the day, if like
it's gonna reinforce the
if they're gonna
negativity.
Fire you, they're gonna fire you. Like, I mean, I've been fired.
You've been
like,
fired?
Yeah, I mean, it happens. But like, if they're gonna fire you, they're gonna fire you. But at the end of the day, like, you have to also just focus on what you're doing.
Yeah.
And if they're not happy with it, then you know, there's nothing you can really control about it.
Do you feel like when you look back in like these kind of conversations or whenever you have an opportunity to think about what you've been able to do the last few years, like you've been in a disproportionate amount of movies that have had a lot of drama around it? Do you
know what I mean? Yeah, what the hell?
I was thinking about that when I was like looking at like the films, like whether it's Lone Ranger. I mean, Man from U.N.C.L.E. I wouldn't say is super dramatic, but it has a lot of narratives around it.
Yeah.
Birth of a Nation obviously had a lot going on.
That was slightly dramatic, yeah.
I mean, I'm curious on that one, and this is something that keeps coming up more and more nowadays, and I'm wrestling with it myself. Where do you come down on, like, separating the art from the artist kind of a thing? Do you think about that in terms of, like...
we didn't, like, no one really knew. There was, that was...
Right, that all came out, the next stuff came out after. No one really knew that passed too well.
I don't know, man. Like, for me...
Like, if Polanski wants to work with you, what do you say?
You know, it's funny, man, because part of me as an artist would say... There's not a lot of artists in history who don't have something fucked up about them.
Right.
You know, I mean, you don't find reasonable men at the tops of tall mountains, and sane people don't decide to become artists because it's a weird job with no job security and, you know, whatever. But it's the idealist in me would like to think, you know, okay, I'm not working with Polanski, as you, to use your example, the person. I'm working with him as an artist, and this is a new thing that he's doing, and I think that he is a talented artist or whatever. But at the end of the day, like, as a human and as, you know, someone who's trying to live a virtuous life, you kind of go, is it worth it?
Right.
Like, you know there's just going to be drama. You know it's going to be an issue, and you know that it's going to be something that can overshadow what you're actually trying to do.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, man.
It's not an easy question because, I mean, again,
it's like, full of gray. You know, it's hard.
I mean, I grew up. I mean, Woody Allen, you know, is my spirit animal, as you can imagine, stereotypically. Yeah. And it's like, what do you do with that? Mel Gibson. I grew up with Mel Gibson films. It's all just like,
yeah.
I don't know if I can throw all that out, but I hear everything you're saying. It's a tough one. I don't know.
Yeah, the thing about it's like.
You just, I think, rapped on a film that I'm very intrigued by, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg film, right?
On the Basis of Sex,
yeah, with Felicity, who's lovely and so talented. Yeah,
amazing. She's incredible.
What can you tell me about making that one with Mimi Leder, who's a great filmmaker in her own right?
She's great, yeah. It was an amazing project, and it's such a fascinating thing to get to. To get to really go back in time when the gender landscape in this country was vastly different, when women couldn't rent a car unless their husband was there with them. And I don't even know what, maybe it's because they were afraid their wives were going to run away from the shitty home lives that they had. I don't know. But, like, this is a woman who, just by her own sheer determination and will, changed the landscape of gender law in this country. And she is an exceptionally smart human being who, I mean, Ruth Bader Ginsburg sleeps 3 hours a night because she's too busy reading. Like, I mean, she doesn't own a television and she only listens to opera. Like, she's like that kind of intellect, you know? Right. So, and Felicity Jones did such an amazing job sort of bringing that to life.
That's awesome. I can't wait for that one, man. Do you have a little time off? I know you're going to be helping spread the good word on this one for a bit. So do you know what you're doing next?
No, dude. I'm on the Call Me By Your Name train. Like, I'm going back to L.A. at 5 in the morning to go back to Moore, and then I got to go to Santa Barbara, then I'm back to blah, blah, blah.
Just nonstop talking about dancing and peaches. And
that's it. That's it.
All the important stuff.
Yep. The finer things in life.
Exactly. No, but in all seriousness, you know I'm a fan of this one, and it's a worthy project to spend some time talking about and to urge people to get out and see. And, you know, I feel confident in recommending it to anybody because it just, as we said at the outset, it works for everyone.
Thanks, dude.
I appreciate it. Really proud, man. Good to see you as always.
Nice to see you, Josh. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, man.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.